Talk given Sunday, 11th March, 1973. Today we'll deal with the Upanishads. The scriptures of the world contain teachings by those who are no longer seeking for truth, who are no longer striving for fulfillment. They had found truth. They were themselves the truth. Note Jesus' words, "I am the way, the life, the truth." Sri Krishna in the Gita says identically the same things and more besides. The Buddha said of himself that he was the truth become, the embodiment of truth. It's the same with the teachers of the Upanishads. They were not people who were still in a state of confusion, still in a state of imperfection, human imperfection. They were called, and quite rightly so, the perfected holy ones. And the scriptures of the world contain teachings by such people. What they taught, or what they attempted to convey to disciples and to those who were earnest about such matters, was not a philosophy of life. They were not speculative philosophers. They were people who had realized the truth of life. They had realized what it means to be the perfected man and not be confined to the state of sub-man. So that we must not look to the Upanishads, and perhaps particularly the Upanishads, as well as the original Kabbalah, which is the root of the Judeo-Christian teachings and tradition, we must not look to the Upanishads for a philosophy, for answers to our intellectual curiosity. We must approach the Upanishads in the spirit of meditation, by which I mean in the spirit of attempting to be in complete communion with the truth which lives in the words that those teachers used. The truth about ourselves, about our own lives. If we may put it in intellectual terms, perhaps the most important way to understand the great scriptures is to realize that first and foremost, they express states of consciousness, modes of awareness, of existence, of oneself, above all of transcendence and one's relationship to transcendence. These perfected holy ones, the great teachers, were the embodiments of a realized transcendence. It is not that they had attained transcendence. The finite cannot attain or achieve the infinite. It's totally impossible. It is the infinite, the absolute, the totality, call it what you will, which had realized itself through those individuals who had cleansed themselves of all defilements, who had freed themselves from everything in their own minds and hearts and their way of life, which were an obstruction to the free manifestation of transcendence through man as perfected man, which means the fulfillment of man. So, that is the way we should approach the understanding of the Upanishads and their teachings. Now, the two most important words in the Upanishads are Brahman and Atma. Supposing we approach it as in the spirit of students, naturally we will ask, what is the meaning of Brahman? What is the meaning of the word Atma? Now try and go back in imagination 30 centuries, 35 centuries, and picture for yourselves these people who lived nearby a village, by a stream, in a woodland, perhaps under the shadow of the towering Himalayas. They were concerned with this perfecting of the self, with this becoming the truth. Just try and imagine that for the moment. As far as the intellect is concerned, there are great questions, and these are the two fundamental questions man all over the world, through all ages, has asked. Were, what is ultimate reality? That's one question. The other question is, who am I? What am I? Perfectly natural, isn't it? If you are interested in the deep things. The answer to the question, what is ultimate reality, was summed up in that single word, Brahman. The answer to the question, what am I, who am I, was summed up in the word Atma. And thereafter they made this extraordinary statement, Brahman and Atma are identical. They are an identity. There is no difference. Now, if you try to work this out logically, intellectually, you'll be terrified at its implications. I am God. God is me. That is almost an impossible statement to utter. And it would not be true if an ordinary person, if I, a subhuman, were to make that statement. Nevertheless, that is the actual truth. Brahman and Atma are an identity. Now, in order to understand this, we must look at the way in which they arrived at the answers to their fundamental questions. I don't think you will find what I'm now going to say in any of the books, or at any rate expressed in these terms, which I trust will make it clear and lucid for you. In attempting to answer what is ultimate reality, naturally the mind searched outwards at first, seeking reality in the world of manifestation. And they found that it was impossible to pick upon anything as ultimate reality. They couldn't answer it that way. So they went inwards within themselves. And as far as they themselves were concerned, as they were, in the condition that they were, perplexed, wondering, with defilements of the mind present and so forth, they couldn't answer the question. But, persevering with the search, they saw that insofar as the defilements of the mind and the heart, what we call the vices and all the rest of it, were understood and dissolved, and insofar as all the conditioning of the mind, our biases, prejudices, preconceptions, assumptions, all our memories of what we in our worldly manner discovered and which we thought was true, but which in actual fact is an obstruction to realizing the ultimate reality, when all those were really seen and dissolved, the mind was in a state of perfect emptiness. It was denuded, utterly denuded, of all its preconceptions, assumptions, ideas, pictures formed by the imagination, and so forth and so forth. Now, when this surface mind of ours is completely denuded in that way, the reality of the mind functioning within us at last is born and comes into full activity. An activity which can never be known and described in intellectual analytical terms and expressed in words, because words are always tied up with the limited, the particular, and the finite. Not the absolute, not the eternal truth. But that aspect of the mind starts up into life. It becomes alive altogether. And then one is aware in terms which are quite different, totally different from our terms of awareness. You are not asleep, you are not unconscious in that state. In fact, you are extraordinarily widely awake. But you are awake and aware of existence in terms of its unitary wholeness, and not in terms of differentiated particulars. This is a real experiencing which man is able to enter into. A real experiencing. And in this awareness, in terms of unitary wholeness, all that we thought and believed and imagined and so forth is seen to be inadequate. That is the nicest thing one can say about it. And in many respects, it is false, it is misleading. It is of the nature of darkness, not of enlightenment. So now, entering within, completely denuding the mind of all that clutters it, and awakening in this way from within to the full awareness of the unitary wholeness of the totality, they saw that, yes, this is ultimate reality, but how shall I talk about it? I cannot talk about it. So I invented a word, Brahman. I'm saying I, but those people 30 and 35 centuries ago. Brahman. Now, with respect to the question, who am I? They went through the identical process. There was no other way of doing it. But because the question had a subjective flavor as contrasted with the objective flavor of what is ultimate reality, the one was a sort of objective scientific approach. This was a subjective psychological approach, intuitive if you like, an approach of inner insight. And they arrived at the same state of awareness, the awareness of unitary wholeness, of the totality of existence as well as of oneself. So you see, the two answers, which were given different names in order to distinguish the objective from the subjective approach, stood for the same thing. The only real meaning of the word I is the totality itself. We, in our ignorance, in our clouded condition, our circumscribed condition, think of ourselves, each one of us, as separate from the other fellow. Perfectly true. Our consciousness, being what it is, our capacity for awareness, being what it is, this precisely is the way we are conscious. And if we are prepared to accept the limited context in which we function, then it is perfectly true that thou and I are separate, two different persons. But if you go into it more and more deeply, and if you free your own mind from all its defilements and its conditioning, you will find that the separation is in actual fact, in actual material fact, so to say, an illusion. It is not a reality. Two bodies are separate. But in terms of consciousness, that separation is bridged. Take the actual fact of our experience. Supposing somebody is sitting behind me in a large room, and I don't know for the moment that he has come and sat down there. I will say to myself, I'm the only person in this room. But supposing I turn round, or he coughs or something, and I turn round and see him, the act of hearing, the act of seeing, has done something. In the ordinary way, I say, oh, there's John Smith sitting behind me. But the act of seeing and the act of hearing has linked John Smith with me. I am holding John Smith in my consciousness, just as he is holding me in his consciousness. So you see, to be conscious of is the way in which limitation disappears and the wholeness supervenes, which is the reality. So now, when through the purification one is aware of the totality of existence, of oneself, of others, of transcendence, in terms of the unitary wholeness, the word I has expanded in consciousness to include the totality. And that is the only real meaning of the word I. That is the immortal I, my eternal spirit, my immortal soul, if I like to use those terms. And to this they gave the name Atma. Now you understand why they said Brahman and Atma are an identity. Now it is extremely important really to understand this. That is, not merely see it through the power which the intellect has of logical deduction, not as a logical deduction. Because that is of hardly any avail in changing our lives. Our lives have to become pure. Our lives have to become truly human lives and not subhuman lives, full of violence, full of fear, suspicion, hate, jealousy, envy, ambition, evil. So we have to understand and not merely intellectually deduce or intellectually accept, because then you are merely accepting a string of words without a living power in them to transform your very existence. All right. So to understand means that what you see first intellectually as something separate has now an added dimension. The sensitivity, which we sometimes call feeling in oneself, has sort of gone over and touched and completely absorbed that which the intellect has seen as standing apart from oneself. Now, when this happens fully, and your whole mind has absorbed that which the intellect has seen, so that which the intellect has seen has become part and parcel of your psychical mental being, then you have understood. Now, in that kind of understanding, love comes into its own. Compassion, mercy, loving kindness, all those things have come into their own. And when the intellect and the heart are completely in harmony with each other, in their perfection, then there is understanding, there is wisdom. Now, we must look at another aspect of all this. I have already mentioned that one reaches the answers by going within and becoming purified in the act of going within. It hasn't got to be a cold-blooded intellectual act of analysis. That's useless. But a real going within with reverence, in the spirit of wanting to understand, in the spirit of being in full and complete communion with the reality. And I have mentioned that this new dimension of the mind springs to life. What is this new dimension of mind and consciousness? When does it spring into life? And why did I say that it cannot be known in analytical verbal terms? When you go within, in the real sense, what happens is that all the sense functions become pacified. They become peaceful. They are not suppressed. You don't deliberately shut them out, as so many self-styled teachers will say you must do. You must repress the sense activities. Oh no, not at all. The senses will be functioning. But they will be functioning in peace. What do I mean by that? How do the senses function in the ordinary way? When I see something, my mind immediately talks back at it, passes judgments, says, oh, I like that, I don't like that, that's true, that's false. Oh, this is interesting. Oh, this is utterly boring. Etc., etc., etc. I never stop chattering in my mind. The chattering ape inside is perpetually active. I don't see, therefore. I merely look, get an impression, and immediately this ape starts jumping about, making a noise, and spreading ugliness. That is how I see. That is also how I hear, and touch, and taste, and smell. But now, when I begin to be sensible, in the real sense of the word, when I begin to be sensible, I just look without talking back at the impression conveyed to me by my sense of sight. And so too with the other senses. So too when I am, in the, as we say in the ordinary way, thinking or studying or trying to work out something in my mind. I don't talk back at it. I really observe it. And in this observation, in which I am not talking back at the thing, all my sense functions are functioning peacefully. Now notice another extraordinary thing that happens thereby. When I talk back at the functions of my senses, I never learn from what the senses convey to me. I pick and choose. I like that. This is what I'm looking for. I've got it. This is the way of the idiot. And I'm an idiot all my life till I wake up to this fact. And that is why I do wrong things all along the line. So, when I stop talking like that, I discover in the most amazing manner all my conditioning intellectually, all my defilements morally. They just come up. Now as I see them, as I perceive them one by one, or two or three or 20 at a time, I do not, on seeing them, get a reaction of approval, this is a fine virtue which I have, or a capacity I have, nor do I feel an aversion, this is a horrible vice I have. If I do that, then my approval will make me morally and spiritually conceited, and we know what spiritual pride is like. And if I have aversion, I will fight against it, which means I am fighting against a part of myself. You try fighting against yourself. Try the way of war with yourself. There'll be lots of funerals very soon, within yourself. And then, no realization, no truth. Only a miserable ending. That is all. But if I do not talk back like that all the time, this flow of discursive thought and all the illusions and mistakes and absurdities associated with it, they all calm down and dissolve away. Their dissolution must not be pictured as throwing the waste paper into the dustbin. Not at all. This waste paper, instead of being thrown into the dustbin, is transformed into something very wonderful. Because, in this case, the waste paper is your own psyche. It is true that physically, if one is sufficiently ill, sometimes we have to perform an operation. Well, out goes your appendix or your tonsils forever and ever. Or maybe one kidney goes away forever and ever. Or one lung, and the body will continue with just the other kidney or the other lung. True enough. But with the psyche, it's not like that. With the body, these material organs are all separate. The psyche functions as a whole all the time. When you get angry, it's not the bit of your psyche which is behind your head which has got angry. when you are feeling very affectionate or some such thing, it is not the bit of psyche in front of your lips which has got affected. It's the whole of the psyche which is affected. It functions as a totality all the time. So you can't have operations on the psyche. So what happens? When you see the defilements, when you become really aware and completely see through all the conditioning, that psychical energy which is manifesting in this ill manner is transformed into a healthy, efficient psyche. This is the difference. And when the mind is healthy, it has ceased to chatter. And not only has it ceased to chatter, it has ceased to grasp. It has ceased to hate. It is no longer liable to delusion, as the Buddha said. All these things happen. And then the mind at last has entered into its own and its real function is fulfilled. What is its real function? The power of intelligence comes through unhindered. And by power of intelligence, I mean precisely this. You are able now to see the truth of anything, of any person, of any situation with unerring insight. You know things, persons, situations, events for what they actually are. This is intelligence. Not all the acquired fixations which form our criteria and standards of judgment and so on. Judgment in the wrong sense is out of the situation altogether. Because judgment in the wrong sense means conflict, means evil, means sorrow. So it is this power of the mind, of the healthy mind, which springs into action. The perfected holy ones were people of that nature. And it was they who produced the teachings of the Upanishads, as of the Kabbalah, as of the Bible, or the Buddhist teachings, and all the rest of it. They produced that. Much accretion, of course, has taken place, and therefore the scriptures of the world are very troublesome documents to read. You have to use plenty of good sense and devote your whole life to sifting the wheat from the chaff. Sometimes it is almost like looking for the needle in the haystack. But if you are pure, if you are truly earnest, your eyes will have the extraordinary capacity to see that shining needle inside the haystack. This is the point. So now the holy ones were that sort. So they taught, or rather shall I say, suggested, rather than laid down, they suggested certain ways of life by which this cleansing process may take place. That is the very practical, moral, mental aspect of religious teaching. What is all that based upon? It is based upon the fact that they themselves had become so purified that transcendence realized itself through them. And in that realization by transcendence of itself through the individual, that individual was completely changed. and the individual knows that. When you are enlightened, when you are the perfected Holy One, you will know that you are the changed one. You will function quite differently. And so a great deal, all their moral and other teaching derives from the fact that they were the perfected holy ones. It does not start from worldly knowledge, from intellectual knowledge, from the knowledge of science or philosophy or art or this, that or the other, and then try to work up to something which is named transcendence. Now you see why the scriptures are called the voice of God. The Hindus say that the Vedas, the Rig Veda, the Sama Veda, Yajurveda, and the Atharva Veda, perhaps not the Atharva, but certainly the other three, and especially the Rig Veda, are the words of Brahma himself. You know how the fundamentalists believe that every word of the Bible is the word of God himself. Now in that almost stupid statement, it sounds almost stupid, nevertheless there is an extraordinary truth hidden in it. Our business, if we really care for the truth, is to sift the wheat from the chaff. See the truth of it. Not just belief. Mere belief will be a hindrance. It will totally prevent you from getting anywhere. You'll be fiddling about and imagining all kinds of things about yourself, that, oh, now you've attained this stage and that stage and you're getting on the path, and before long you'll be enlightened. Then you can throw a party to celebrate the enlightenment. No, that's all nonsense. But see this fact, that out of the state of realized transcendence emerges the whole of the scriptural teaching. I said whole, but I mean the real part of it. There has been too much accretion of other things that we have to sift out. That is why to live the religious life becomes very difficult. Extremely difficult. It is as if, instead of starting from the kindergarten and then working upwards and getting to the sixth form, and if you do reasonably well or fairly well there, you can get into university and all the rest of it. It starts the other way around. It starts from the other shore. This is the great point about it. You don't start from what you are and work up to the ultimate truth or God. It is, you start with God, which means you just give up self altogether, straight away. It's quite easy. Believe me, it's quite easy to do. To see that, if you can see some of these things which I've tried to put before you quite clearly, you will find that, of course, that is the obvious thing. So, the Upanishads start with Brahman and Atma. They do not say how or why or how they attained Brahman or Atma, although the word attained unfortunately is used. How the realization took place, that they don't talk about so much. They talk about Brahman and Atma and what comes out of that. Now, is that quite clear? Because if that is quite clear, we can really enter into a proper study of the Upanishads in the real sense. Now, you know that all the religions of the world talk about creation. Genesis starts off with creation. And as the words stand, it is hopelessly and completely misunderstood. The words, as they stand literally, don't mean what we think that they mean. It's the same with the Upanishads. And with the Upanishads, there is this greater difficulty. Genesis was written in code. All the Kabbalistic teaching originally is in a code. We have to crack that code, so to say, and understand. But at least the translations where the Old Testament are concerned, at least where the Old Testament is concerned, the translations can make a certain degree of sense. The Upanishads, well, very few parts of them will make literal, logical sense. This is what we have to beware of. When the Upanishads talk in terms of the various deities, when they correlate the deities to the elements, you know, the old idea of elements, earth, air, fire, water, and so forth, when they correlate all that to different parts of the body and the functions of the body and to the mind and so forth, they are hopelessly misleading if you don't sort of understand, if you haven't got the key to unlock what it all really means. And then it is something tremendous. I have already given one or two hints, as far as I could, of this profound aspect of the mind which comes into play. Now, let us look at something said in connection with creation in the Brihadaranyaka Upanishad. It starts off with the statement, this particular part of it, it's the first chapter, the fourth section. And in the first verse it is said, in the beginning there was only Atma in the form of a person. Then it goes on to say, looking around and seeing no other than himself, he said, I am. Now, how is it possible for a person to look around, see no other than himself, and say, I am? The very word other has no meaning whatsoever if you're the only one that is. Otherness is outside your consciousness. I'm saying this in order to impress upon you the tremendous difficulty of really penetrating into the true meaning of these things. Then it goes on to explain the meaning of the word person. And the Sanskrit word is Purusha. And they say that formally, and the word for formally is Purva. You see, formally, he, they just say he, actually the person who wrote it or taught it was referring to himself entering the deep states of meditation. Formally, he burnt out all ill, all evil-mindedness. Sarvam papmanam. Sarvam is all, papmanam, papa is sin, manam mind, the sinful-mindedness. He burnt out all sinful-mindedness, burnt the root, the Sanskrit root of the word burnt is ush. So now they combined the pur part of formerly, purva, and the ush part, and made purusha, the person. This is the person. Now you see, what it means is that you yourself, embarking upon this journey of discovery, burnt out all evil-mindedness, and thereby you became the person. But you were a person to start with, as we would say in English, wouldn't we? But this is the real meaning of Purusha, the one in whom all evil-mindedness is burnt out. Now, looking around, this is the state of the Atma. If all evil-mindedness is burnt out, that's why I gave you this long preliminary explanation about the process by which the words Brahman and Atma came about. If this evil-mindedness is completely burnt out, you look around and you will see nobody else like yourself. You'd be exceptionally fortunate if you met another person who was also the perfected Holy One sitting next to you. You see the point? So he said, I am. Now what is the significance of the I am? Refer to Exodus. When Moses asks, Elohim, Yahweh Elohim, you have to combine the two names. Just God is not enough. The Lord God. Yahweh Elohim. When he asks Yahweh Elohim, what shall I say to the Israelites as to who sent me? Yahweh gives him an assignment to go and get the Israelites to out of their captivity from Egypt. And Moses says, if I go there and they ask me, who are you? Who hath sent you? What shall I say to them? And Yahweh Elohim answers, say unto them, Thee I am hath sent you. Thee I am. Ehye. I am that I am is Ehye Asher Ehye. Now, Thee I am, as I explained to you, the real I am is the totality. This infinite reality, this ultimate truth, is the thing that gives you the assignment of religious liberation. That is the I am. And this is the person to whom that assignment is given. So Purusha is the one in whom all evil-mindedness is burnt out. That's the form in which the Upanishad puts it. The Judaic form, Moses is by the burning bush. Fire again comes into the story. It's very interesting. Right. So, Purusha. Now, the Upanishad goes on to say, he, referring to Purusha, verily had no delight. Therefore, one who is alone has no delight. And the Sanskrit is na ramate. Delight in the sense of playing. Ramate is to play. He desired a second. Then it goes on to say, he was indeed as large as a woman and a man close conjoined. A woman and a man close conjoined. He caused that very being, that is himself, to fall apart into two parts. The root for fall apart is pat. The Sanskrit root is pat. From that arose the sovereign lord, pati, which means a husband, and the lady, patni, meaning a wife. I'll go into details explaining this to you. Hence, Yajnavalkya, who is one of the greatest of the Upanishadic teachers, used to say, oneself is like a half fragment. That is, we as we are, bodily, are like half fragments. Therefore, this void, this emptiness, and the word is akasha, which, as I have explained in previous meetings, really means mind space, not space in the ordinary sense that we understand space. It's mind space. And the important thing to realize here is that mind space is immeasurable. It's non-finite. Therefore, it has none of the limitations which are associated with space as we ordinarily know of space in the world, and therefore the limitations of all sense functions, because sense functions convey everything that is limited. You see? Therefore, this void is filled with the feminine. He, the sovereign lord, conjugated with her, the lady. Therefrom were produced beings with intelligence, manushya. Now, listen carefully. In the beginning, as they say, was Atma. In the beginning, in the scriptures, or in the Hindu-Buddhist writings, they sometimes use the word now. Either they use the word agre, in the beginning, or atta, now. And they both have no relationship to time and space, which is the ordinary meaning. In the beginning or now means you in the state of realized transcendence, the infinite, the immortal, that which has no beginning, no death. You see, the immeasurable condition. That's what in the beginning means in the great scriptures. From that state, coming to the state of self-awareness as such, the person is, you are aware of yourself as person. Now, yourself as person corresponds, the Purusha corresponds to Adam of chapter 1 of Genesis. The 26th verse, I think. And Elohim said, let us make man in our own image. Male, female made he man. The word for man in Hebrew is Adam. Adam is the word for man. You see? And this refers to the primordial man, Adam Kadmon. Let us make man in our own image. You see? Adam Kadmon. And he is made male, female. Remember, that means that these transcendent energies are dual in nature, positive, negative, to use modern scientific terminology. Positive charges, negative charges, electricity or whatever it is, you see. Male, female made he them. Then in chapter 2, this living soul, which is called Adam, you see, needed a suitable help. So the Lord God caused a sleep to fall upon Adam, another deep state of consciousness. And on awakening, there is not Eve, but Esha, femininity. The name Eve comes afterwards. after the fall, Adam gives the name Eve. But before the fall, it's the feminine principle. And Adam of the second chapter is the masculine principle. He, the sovereign Lord, as I read here, and the lady. The two principles. And this consciousness, this state of meditation into which Adam entered, was one in which he realized, this conjoined male-female, realized that there is this duality starting right from the transcendent realms almost. See? And the Upanishad puts it in this form, he caused it to fall, them to fall apart. Whereas in Genesis, you have Adam. Adam is still called Adam, but he's Adam Kadmon, really, not the earthly Adam. And there is the feminine principle of femininity. Now, it is the principle of femininity which is the inquiring principle, which is the active principle. The male principle just looks on and influences all process by sheer presence. So we have in the Sankhya philosophy, Purusha, by his presence, makes Prakruti start up the entire world process. The positive as well as the negative parts. And they come into play, into interaction. He had no delight, as it is said here, na ramate, no play, no interplay, no interaction. Now, when we come to Adam of the third chapter, you see, now we are coming to the one who falls, that is called. That fall and disobedience is a hopelessly wrong way of looking at the whole thing. When the so-called fall takes place, then the two principles are quite separate, embodied in male bodies and female bodies as such. And as it is said in the Upanishad, this sovereign Lord conjugated with the lady. Therefrom were produced beings with intelligence. Manushya. Human beings like you and me. These are the stages of descent of consciousness from the primordial realization of transcendence, which is without differentiation, into the world of particulars, step by step, where there is differentiation.